This is the Topics and Takes podcast with Lauren Brownlow. You can download this weekly podcast at WRALSportsFan.com and the WRAL SportsFan app, or subscribe on iTunes and Google Play stores now. Here's your host for the Topics and Takes podcast, Lauren Brownlow.
Welcome to Topics and Takes. I am Lauren Brownlow from WRALSportsFan.com and 99.9 The Fan. And this week, I am joined by one of the most esteemed writers in the ACC, and I don't think that he would argue even that statement at this point, David Teal from the Daily Progress. Did I get it right? I always get it wrong, your paper.
It's the Daily Press.
The Daily Press. Gosh. Okay. Well, there you go. The Daily Press.
That's all right.
Okay. And you have covered Virginia athletics now for how long?
I've been in the state, Lauren, since 1984.
Wow. Okay. And how long? That's how long you've been in media, yes?
No.
No.
I graduated from James Madison in 81. And after that, did short stints at three different papers, including Fayetteville, North Carolina.
I didn't know you worked in Fayetteville. Wow. Okay.
I did, as I was in Fayetteville when I covered my first Final Four in 1983 in Albuquerque with the Wolfpack.
No, that was your first Final Four.
I was a 24-year-old punk, totally out of his league. And I get a phone call from my boss at the time, Bill Kirby Jr., and he says, the Wolfpack has won two games in this tournament. I need you to get on an airplane to Ogden, Utah. And lo and behold, the Wolfpack win two games in Ogden, including one over Ralph Sampson and UVA, Sampson's final collegiate game, at which point my phone rings in the hotel and Kirby says, hope you can find the laundromat because you're not coming home. You're going to Albuquerque to the Final Four.
That was the first time you'd covered NC State at that point, right?
I had seen NC State maybe once or twice during the regular season. We had a small staff, and whoever could get to different places would go. But the postseason assignment was completely out of the blue. And needless to say, I was just like, wow.
What was the experience like covering them?
Valvano, as everyone knows, was such... he was an entertainer. And my favorite story from that trip was, we're in Albuquerque kind of before everyone gets there, because the Wolfpack didn't come home either. They just went straight from Ogden to Albuquerque. And we were staying in separate hotels, but every morning we would go over to the lobby of the state hotel where Jimmy V would just hold court. With several of us. Carlton Tudor was on the trip, Leonard Lay from the Charlotte Observer, you know, guys I looked up to. I'm trying to learn from them. And the night before, John DeLong and I, and maybe a couple other guys, had gone out. I'm going to date myself, which I'm sure we'll do many times during this conversation. We went and saw Huey Lewis in the news somewhere in Albuquerque.
That's awesome.
Stayed out too late, of course. So we're in the lobby with Valvano the next morning. And here comes through the lobby Huey and the band. So we're like, hey, man, great show last night, yada, yada, yada. And Valvano looks at us and he goes, I'm the show, not them.
Was he being serious?
No.
Okay.
But guess what? He wasn't serious, but he was right.
That is true. That's amazing. It dates you, but look, Huey Lewis in the news endures even now. So it's really.
Don't they, though?
They do. I want to back up a little bit, as awesome as that is, that was your first Final Four, because I want to point out that this is, how many Final Fours in a row have you covered now?
Not in a row. I've missed several.
Oh, you have missed some. Okay.
Oh, I have, with newspaper cutbacks and such. I haven't missed any ACC tournaments. I've done 35 consecutive ACC
tournaments. Okay, that's your streak. I got you.
And a whole bunch of, and that many NCAA tournaments. But in terms of the Final Four, I've missed some, but I've been to the last couple, and this year I am honored to be the president of the United States Basketball Writers Association. So I will be presiding over our events in Minneapolis.
Oh, well, that's certainly well-deserved. And yeah, that's a good enough reason to go, even if there's no ACC team there, which there always seems to be one somehow or another. But I did want to back up a little bit to when you're coming from James Madison, or when you're in school at James Madison, what was sort of your projected career track at that point? Were you trying to be a sports writer? Were you trying to be in journalism? What were you thinking you were going to do?
Lauren, it's the only job I've ever wanted, and it's the only job I've ever had.
That's awesome.
And yeah, I mean, blessings don't come much greater. And I owe it all to my dad. My dad used to put the sports section of the newspaper under my pillow every morning before he left for work. And I would get up and devour it. And then on the weekends, I would watch games on TV. And one time my dad got so tired of me planting my butt on the floor or the couch watching sports that he handed me a pencil and a piece of notebook paper and said, "Why don't you write about what you're watching?" And I was 8 years old, not 9 years old. Wow. And so I did. And a couple of those stories somehow survived on that notebook paper.
And no they kidding. Are framed.
And my wife, bless her heart, had them framed, and they hang in the living room downstairs. In all their tortured cursive glory.
Cursive, wow.
Yes.
What did young Teal? What was young Teal's writing style when writing about games?
Very basic. and it was the Baltimore Colts, my favorite team, who would eventually crush my soul by losing to Joe Namath and the Jets in Super Bowl III.
Wow. Okay, so that is a very thorough answer, actually. Who planted the seed and when you knew you wanted to do it? So you were 8 years old when you knew you wanted to go down this path, or thought you might.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah.
Do you remember how old you were when you first got published anywhere?
You know, I was in high school, and we had a student newspaper there, and I was published there. And then there was a little community newspaper called I grew up, well, I was born in Jersey, but then we moved to Baltimore, and I spent most of my youth in Baltimore. And there was a little community newspaper there called the Towson Times, and they would take stories from high school kids about the local high school teams. And I didn't write about, I played basketball very poorly. But I would write about our lacrosse team or our baseball team. And I would write it out longhand. And then my mom, who was an accomplished typist and who couldn't stand to watch me type with two fingers, which I still do.
You still do?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, no.
I was so bad at high school typing class that one day my teacher tossed me the keys to her car and said, "I have a flat tire. Why don't you go change it?"
Oh, gosh. Does it?
I was much better at changing the tire than I was at the home row.
Have you become quicker with that style, or are you still?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So you've at least adapted it to, you know, get deadline.
I don't miss deadline.
So when you were growing up in Baltimore, how much awareness, if any, did you have of sort of the ACC? Was that what you were paying attention to as a kid, or were you watching other leagues, or what awareness did you have of ACC football and basketball at that point?
Lefty Driesell and Maryland.
Ah, well, obviously, right.
hail to the chief. Lefty coming out of the locker room, flashing the V sign, and he beat Frank McGuire in South Carolina in a stall game. I think it was 32-30. In 68 or 69, in that range, maybe 70. Score was maybe 4-2 at halftime.
Oh, man.
And I was just enthralled. And then the Terps landed Tom McMillan and Len Elmore and John Lucas from Durham. And then they had those epic games against David Thompson and North Carolina State and Carolina and Dean. And Lefty was always the foil. I mean, he couldn't overcome those guys most years and never could win an ACC tournament. And the first ACC tournament I ever covered, 1984 in Greensboro, was the only one that Lefty ever won. And that was so, for someone who grew up the way I did watching his program, to see him hoist that trophy, that was pretty cool.
Wow. Yeah. So did you go to games as a kid as well?
You know, we didn't.
Okay.
I actually played in Coalfield House with my high school team. We made the high school state semifinals two straight years when I was a junior and senior. So I played in Coal, and I attended Lefty's basketball camp 2 years and stayed in the dorms. And I tease Lefty to this day because he's retired in Virginia Beach. I mean, Lefty coached Newport News High School, 10 minutes from my house where I currently live, the old Newport News High School, which no longer exists, but I could probably get there in 10 or 15 minutes. But Lefty's retired in Virginia Beach, and it was so cool to see him being announced into the Basketball Hall of Fame at last year's Final Four. But I teased him. I said, Lefty, you don't remember this, but not once, but twice, I won the free throw championship at your camp. And he just laughs.
Did you you really did?
Yes.
That's awesome.
I wish I had the trophy somewhere.
As a fellow person who was not very good at basketball, I also won the free throw. I think it was like our Knights of Columbus district free throw shooting contest when I was a kid.
Awesome.
It must be something about that, you know, not as good on the court, but we could shoot a little bit, you know? Got to get the fundamentals.
No question. Yes.
That's so great. So at what point, I don't remember the first job you said you had out of college.
It was a twice weekly paper in Ocean City, Maryland.
Oh my gosh.
Where I was covering rec league softball and fishing tournaments and surfing contests. And then I wasn't there long. And then went from there to Lynchburg, Virginia. That was my first daily. And then from there to Fayetteville. And then from there to here in Newport News.
Wow. And you've been there since 84, I think you said?
April of 84. I came here, Lauren, after covering the 84 NCAA tournament for Fayetteville. Mm-hmm. I went to Pullman, Washington, and watched Mike Krzyzewski coach his first NCAA tournament game.
Wow. Wow. That's crazy.
In which he will, to this day, tell you that he got hosed by the refs.
still not over it, yeah.
No, and Billis will tell you the same thing because he and I have talked about it.
Oh, my gosh. That's great. Yeah, wow. And so when you started covering the teams in Virginia, was your primary responsibility Virginia, or were you looking ACC wide, or what was sort of your range of what you were covering?
Primarily in the early years, it was UVA. It was football and basketball because mm-hmm. George Welsh was getting the program going, and then in 1989 they shared the ACC title, which was a first for the program. And then in 1990, rose to number one in the polls. It was one of the most remarkable rises in college football annals because the program had been such a joke. But, you know, Terry Holland, who's a North Carolinian, he was the head basketball coach for my first, 5 or 6 years here before Jeff Jones took over. And they were always good. And Virginia Tech was more of an afterthought. They were an independent at mm-hmm. the time in football and played in the Metro Conference in basketball. But then, as you know, once Virginia Tech football became big, and you know, then they get in the Big East, and then the ACC, and then I became morphed into more of a columnist role. It's been both schools for a long, long time now.
Okay. And by the way, this is the Topics and Takes podcast. We are joined by David Teal, who has covered the ACC, I guess we could say full time since 1984.
Yeah.
And the Virginia schools mainly, but everyone to a pretty large extent, really. I mean, I think your ACC knowledge is as extensive as anyone that is covering any ACC school. So,
well, you're very kind, and I was lucky back in the day of bigger newspaper staffs and such. You know, we would have a beat writer dedicated to both UVA and Virginia Tech, which we no longer have, but back then we did. And then with me in more of a columnist and freelance role, you know, I was on Tobacco Road all the time. Duke Carolina, Duke in the Final Four, and Duke in NCAA tournaments. I mean, the whole Leitner thing with Hurley and Duke Kentucky. I was there at the Spectrum, right by the Duke bench, and you know, you can't make up how lucky I was.
It's interesting for being around here. I think a lot of us either grew up in this area or a fan of one of the teams, and so we tend to view things through a North Carolina centric lens, I feel, or Tobacco Road centric lens. And you sort of grew up either as a kid or when you got older, first covering the league. I think covering people and personalities that sort of had an antithetical, like sort of a relationship with Tobacco Road that wasn't always as friendly. Lefty Driesell, certainly Terry Holland.
Yes,
as well.
Terry Holland, absolutely. Well, you know, the old story, I mean, Terry named his dog Dean.
Yep, I know that story. And it was not meant to be flattering.
No, it was not. No, they absolutely, I mean, the rivalries were fierce, and it was great theater back then. And
yes,
I mean, everybody you played everybody twice every year, and not only that, you played everybody in the second half of the season in the same order in which you played them in the first. This was the double round robin in
right.
basketball.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was so structured, and it was great.
Yes. Yeah. No, it was. But I thought that was interesting, because certainly that would give you a perspective on, especially because you covered, like you said, you were here covering Tobacco Road, Duke Carolina stuff. And then you still are coming at it from the perspective of knowing what, you know, outsiders felt about this area. Being around those types of personalities, how did you feel then in terms of the way they viewed it, as the ACC was very North Carolina centric to a fault, I guess? How did you sort of view that, being around them and having a chance to have a little bit of a, I don't want to say a balanced perspective, but I'm sure you saw the league from multiple sides and multiple angles. So what did you think about that?
I did, or I tried to, but clearly it was a North Carolina centric
sure.
league with half the membership right there, and they were very protective of that. And you know, Rick Barnes going after Dean yeah. at the ACC tournament, and you know, Gary Williams and Lefty always talking about Carolina or Duke refs, and Gene Corrigan, the commissioner at the time, mm-hmm. how he and Fred Barakat, who was the director of basketball, how they refereed those spats is beyond me.
Must have been delicate. Yeah.
Absolutely.
So you've covered Virginia Tech, both football and basketball, for a while.
Sure.
This weekend, we don't do too much that's dated on this Topics and Takes podcast, but I wanted to get into this aspect of Virginia Tech football quickly, if we could, because it's
sure.
something that's always been a curiosity for me, and I have not been able to get the world's best answer on this. I have sensed, especially in the last few years, this sort of dislike of North Carolina football from Virginia Tech football, and from my perspective, it seems a little bit like Virginia Tech is kind of a name program, a storied program with a tradition and a name, and obviously much more football-centric place than North Carolina is. And to see sort of even like the official social media account taking like shots at North Carolina football, and you see this
yes.
just the weird, there's this weird animosity there that I seem to feel, and I don't know if maybe I'm misinterpreting it, but it just seems to feel like a little bit of, as the kids say, beefing down on the part of Virginia Tech. And I guess I'm curious if you can give me any insight as to where, am I reading this correctly for one thing? And secondly, is this, where does it come from?
I'm not sure it's that strong, Lauren, with the fans.
Right. Okay.
Because I'm not sure how accurate a reflection Twitter is of the entire fan base, which is probably a good thing.
Yes.
But a large part of this is rooted in the Hurricane game of 2 years ago when the Tar Heels were ranked and Tech goes in there in a game that I think we all agree never should have been played.
Yes.
But the Hokies just housed them.
Mm-hmm.
And in the aftermath, Tech fans sensed that Carolina fans were making excuses, and that wasn't going to sit well with them. We both played on the same field, yada, yada, yada.
Yep.
And I think maybe what ignited it even a little more was the previous year in 2015. Who beat Virginia Tech in Frank Beamer's final home game at Lane Stadium?
Oh, and on a little bit of a controversial call, if I remember correctly.
And Tech came from way back and was trying to win it late and fell just short. So there's no storybook ending. And that stuck in some craws as well.
Yeah. Okay. You're right. It's a fair thing about Twitter because that's not always an accurate reflection. But I've been struck by it at times where it's just like, I think you guys could do better in terms of a rival that you want to take shots at. I don't know.
Well, in Virginia Tech Twitter, even the official Twitter is not above taking shots.
I have noticed that.
They're trying to have fun,
right,
and they're trying to beef up their following. But hey, I've tweeted things I regret.
Sure.
And I think if you shot some of the folks there with some sodium pentothal, they can see that, that probably wasn't the best thing to tweet.
Every fan base has almost their own unique personality and vibe to them, not to sort of group all fans within the same group, but North Carolina fans are known as basketball centric and having a little bit of a snobbiness to them. I think Virginia fans kind of fall into a similar vein for the most part. But how would you categorize Virginia Tech fans? Because they're still, in a way, they still feel like they're sort of new to the league in terms of knowing a lot about their fan base and what they're sort of all about.
Little chip on their shoulder, right?
I have sensed that.
Yes. No, and I think that's a fair description. And that's how their teams have tried to play. It's not like Blacksburg, Virginia has been a magnet for five-star recruits in either sport. They get kids whom they think they can develop, and they often do, and they instill them with that underdog mentality, and their fans are the same way. And let's not forget that when the ACC added Virginia Tech, it was only because the ACC had to add Virginia Tech
yes,
to get Miami and Boston College. That was the only way it was going to happen. So, Virginia Tech kind of thought, well, we're not even their first choice. And then people are wondering, saying out loud, oh, Virginia Tech will never win anything in the ACC. And then lo and behold, in 2004, in their first year of membership, the Hokies win the ACC football championship.
Gosh, it was 2004, wasn't it? It really isn't that new. It's been almost 15 years.
Yeah.
It's crazy. It's really crazy. I did want to, what do you think that the Virginia Tech football program's ceiling is? In college football, it's a little bit tougher to be upwardly mobile sometimes. So what do you think that at the end of the day their ceiling can be with Justin Fuente?
Well, I think history would indicate that top 10, top 5 in that range, we can all talk about how recruiting rankings are overdone and they can be misleading and such. But the numbers show that in the current era, it's those who do attract all the five stars who are winning national championships. Could Virginia Tech eventually get there under Justin Fuente? Sure, why not? But would it happen on a consistent basis? That's a little hard to envision, just because they've gotten there once, and that was at 1999 with a signature talent in Michael Vick.
Yeah, no, that's very true. Going into this year at Virginia, it felt like Bronco Mendenhall and BYU, you know, coming from BYU, it felt like maybe that wasn't as good a coach as he is, and I actually think he is a very good coach. Maybe it wasn't going to end up being the fit at Virginia. They seem to be pretty decent this year. I don't know if I'd call them good, but I think that they're better than last place in the Coastal, which is where they were picked. I think they're pretty clearly better than that. What do you think about Bronco's fit in Charlottesville? Has it evolved since he's been there? Do you think it will continue to evolve in a positive way? What do you think about his long-term prognosis there?
That's a question that I have wrestled with ever since Virginia hired him, because he was such an outside-the-box hire. Virginia and Virginia Tech were both searching for coaches simultaneously with the firing of Mike London and the retirement of Frank Beamer. Justin Fuente was in everybody's stories speculating about who might be the next Virginia coach. Bronco Mendenhall was in no one's stories speculating about who was going to be UVA's next coach.
No.
It was just such a – first of all, he was going from an incredibly successful program. He won 99 games in 11 years, and he's coming to UVA, huh? Why? It was almost like Buzz Williams leaving Marquette basketball, right?
Yeah.
For Virginia Tech.
You just go, what,
face
why?
Value. Yeah, you're scratching your head going, what the heck are they thinking? Is this career suicide? But Mendenhall, I think, was tired of the whole independent thing at BYU. He wanted to be in a Power Five conference, wanted to see what that kind of television exposure and money would do for his program. It's all going to come down, Lauren, to whether he and his staff, which is so west of the Mississippi centric, can recruit well enough to compete. I'm still not convinced that they can. Mm-hmm. I think there have been some encouraging signs, particularly this year. They had a stretch of a couple days back in the summer where they landed more four-star guys than they had in their entire tenure combined, and including a big time get out of Cincinnati, a defensive player, and then another guy from the Metro DC area. So that was encouraging for them. And I happen to agree with you. I think he's a top shelf coach, especially on the defensive side. And I've had other coaches tell me that completely unsolicited. They've said, hey, that guy, he knows what he's doing. So they're not going to lack for X and O-ing, especially on that side. They're not going to lack for program management. The guy is obsessive about organizational structure and efficiency down to the last nanosecond of a practice, of a meeting, of how many steps you have to walk from that meeting to the practice field, because I don't want to waste a single moment. He's in a different league. I don't know if I could handle being around him much just on a daily and working in that structure, because you know how our racket is. It's so unstructured and so spontaneous. Yeah. And he is just the complete opposite. He just wants it bam, 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 like clockwork, almost military-like. And how that resonates with today's young people is another question for me. But they have seriously upgraded the quarterback position with Bryce Perkins, particularly as it relates to the offense they want to play, because they want that dual threat guy. Kurt Benkert could throw it through a hurricane, but he couldn't move. Bryce Perkins, he can move now, though I do wonder if NC State and Dave Doran gave opponents a blueprint 2 weeks ago at Carter Finley, because just kind of playing that spy, they really limited Perkins. He was a non-factor with his legs that day.
Yeah, yeah, they did a really good job. I'm not sure how limited he was with his hand being what it was as a thrower, but yeah, that was, they did a really good job containing him in that game.
Yep.
And by the way, this is the Topics and Takes podcast. I am joined by David Teal of the Newport News slash Hampton Roads, I guess, Daily Press.
Yes.
Yes, I have gotten it right this time. And I want to ask you about this because this is something that you've covered really closely, and not everyone has the sort of perspective that you do on it. And you've been on top of the ACC network and its sort of launch and the developments along the way. We're set to launch at some point in 2019.
August
2019. What are you sort of hearing, if anything, about maybe what the non-game programming would be like, and what do you think this network needs to be in terms of it for it to be the financial success it needs to be for the ACC to keep pace with everybody else?
Well, financially, the ACC is not going to get to Big Ten SEC numbers in terms of its annual average distribution to its member schools. I just think the demographics just don't work. Mm-hmm. Those leagues are filled with huge public universities with incredibly large fan bases, where the ACC is such a mix of public and private and smaller schools and larger schools. And you're just not going to generate that kind of television revenue with that eclectic mix. That said, what is essential, you talk to any athletic director in this league, is that the network has to generate enough revenue so that the ACC schools can at least be competitive on the financial end. Now, if college athletics was monopoly, Texas and Ohio State would win everything. Yeah. And when's the last time the Big Ten won an NCAA basketball championship on the men's side?
Was it
Michigan State back in, I don't know, whenever
2000?
Izzo. Yeah.
Oh, geez.
I mean, it's been a long, long time.
I started to say Maryland, but they were ACC at the time, so it doesn't matter.
Yes. No, it absolutely doesn't. But the ACC, the current disparity in revenue is absolutely unsustainable long term. The ACC would get buried. So the network has to close the gap significantly. And that's the question that no one can answer. Will it? Is there optimism? Yes. But as you well know, and Your buddy Joe Ovius, who is so good when it comes to how the younger crowd consumes its media and its ramifications for the network and such. He's so bright about that stuff. No one can predict what the landscape's going to look like in 2 to 5 years. And how it all plays out is going to be fascinating. You asked about non-event programming.
Yes.
I wish I had some insight for you. I really don't. I don't see – there's not an ACC Paul Feinbaum, is
right.
there?
No, there's really not. That's kind of what I was getting at a little bit. Like, what would be the time-filling programs that would go on in the network?
And that's not really – the ACC way, is it?
I mean, no.
I don't know that kind of shtick, for lack of a better word, would go over well with ACC consumers.
What I think I wonder, though, is how, and I don't say this to be negative towards the leadership of the ACC, which I know is doing their jobs the best they can, and I think that they are in touch with what the fan bases think and feel and how the overall attitude of ACC fan is, like you said, it's not friendly to a Feinbaum type personality. It wouldn't really play here. But at the same time, I do wonder if the types of things that might play for ACC fans, which is maybe some humorous type programming or things like that where they poke a little bit of fun of themselves. I wonder, I don't know that that would play either, if for no other reason than I don't know that other schools would be okay with it.
True. And we know how fond the home office in Greensboro is of the Go ACC hashtag.
Yeah, that's, I think about that every now and then. Like, I know Swofford is watching somewhere, even if he's not
ninja.
Looking. He knows. Yeah, the ninja is watching. He is aware that we're using the hashtag, and he's probably rolling his eyes and wishing we could stop.
And one thing about Swofford and the ACC administration, and I hear this question and this criticism a lot from readers, fans, is, how come the ACC was so far behind the SEC and the Big Ten when it came to getting a network? Mm-hmm. And I get that. I understand the question, but I don't think the criticism is fair, because prior to now, the ACC was in no position to launch a network. Number one, ACC football stunk.
Yes.
I mean, it was terrible.
And it had a lot of the problems you touched on as well, in terms of the private school fan bases. I mean, that didn't go away.
Right. And I mean, from 2001 until Jameis Winston and Florida State won a national championship, no ACC team finished in the top five of the final Associated Press poll. None.
Mm. Wow.
So football was terrible. Then ESPN, which is obviously the ACC's media partner, they were busy teaming with the SEC for that network launch. They didn't know if it was going to work. They thought it was. The ACC, or the SEC, had won a gazillion national football championships in a row. So they're figuring, okay, this is going to work. But they don't know for sure. There's no way that ESPN is going to try to launch two conference networks simultaneously.
Right.
Then you add the fact that the ACC didn't have a grant of rights. Then Maryland up and bolts, and everybody's talking about the league splintering. Well, how the heck are you going to launch a network under those conditions?
Yeah, you can't.
No. So it wasn't until all that got settled, grant of rights gets signed, Notre Dame and Louisville come in, Syracuse and Pitt come in. Then all of a sudden, Florida State and Jameis Winston win a national championship and knock off Auburn in the last BCS championship game. Then Florida State makes the playoff. Then Dabo and Clemson. And this has been without question, and it's not even close.
Yeah.
The finest stretch of football in ACC history. So the timing of the network launch is actually ideal. It's basketball. It's still elite. And it's football is at its highest level ever.
Yeah, it's definitely a good time to launch. Can you think of one way that the fans will notice the impact of it? I know we've seen some speculation already, and there's plenty of grumbling around here about start times, especially like lot of noon games. Do you think that will help?
And that little ditty. Oh my gosh, I laughed so hard.
Oh, the Sports Channel 8 guys, yes.
Yes!
It's 12 o'clock somewhere, yeah.
It was so clever. It was great stuff. But I think what fans will definitely see is many games they're accustomed to having on ESPN or even ABC are going to land on the ACC network. And you're going to find more conference games earlier in the season. I mean, Swoff told me back at the kickoff in July, because somebody had whispered in my ear about what had happened at Amelia Island during May meetings, that this was on the table. We're going to have conference basketball games right out of the chute in November, starting
this
next year.
I'm so grumpy about this, by the way.
Well, it
I know. I get it.
I hate to break it to you. Get over yourself, because it's going to happen.
I know.
And the same thing's going to happen in football.
Really? Okay. So we're going to have more of those. Yeah.
More conference games that opening week.
It bothers me less in football because the season is so short. But I think there's just this fundamental part of me that is bothered by the fact that a team would play a conference game in November and then the same conference games would be played like in March and they're not even close to the same. We see how much teams sort of grow and progress. And it, you know, it's one thing for you to count the non-conference wins in terms of a team's NCAA tournament resume. I get why we do that. And a lot of those happen in November, but at the same time, like just the conference part of it, I think it's just the purist in me that's bothered by it. I don't know. I'm probably
I completely agree with you in terms of, you know, the difference in teams in November and March can be so stark. But here's the counter to that. College football, especially now in the playoff era, so dwarfs college basketball in November and December, that basketball is just aching for some kind of bump to start the season. I know Duke does its part with the Champions Classic, with Kentucky, Kansas, and Michigan State, and that helps. But in large measure, the opening of the college basketball season is just a, whatever. Who's in the top three of the college football playoff standings this week?
Right. Yeah.
And that I think hurts the game. I think anything they can do to jazz up November, they're obligated to do. So you combine that with the launch of a new network, and it's like, hey, let's do this. I think it's worth at least a try.
Yeah, no, I hear you. We're joined by David Teal of the Newport News / Hampton Roads Daily Press. No, I hear you. I just wonder how much multitasking people can even do at this point. Like, how much can you devote of your energy? And maybe I'm just thinking of myself. I'm probably being selfish, but how much energy can you devote?
You and me both.
Yeah,
no,
I mean,
I'm with you.
I know. People have been calling me a curmudgeon and saying I need to go complain to Swofford, and I'm not seriously going to do that. However, it is difficult, I think, not just for us, but maybe even for fans to sort of muster up the energy necessary to care that deeply and follow that passionately, you know, conference action in basketball and football in November. So that part of it is a little head scratching to me, but I do understand the need to push for it.
Yeah, no, it's a great point. We all face that in the media, because you are really in such football mode, especially if the team or teams you're covering happen to be in the division hunt or bowl hunt or even national championship hunt. I mean, how would you like to be the folks covering Clemson? And, you know, Dabo's taking you to mid-January for the most part.
Yeah, how'd you like to be Brad Brownell?
Yeah, I was going to say, and there's poor old Brad Brownell, who, by the way, coming off a Sweet 16 season, and all anybody wants to talk about is Kelly Bryant and Trevor Lawrence and Chase Bryce.
And that's the thing too. Yeah, it's just, it's hard. It's hard there because it's hard for them to get traction from a basketball standpoint. And then it's hard for us here who are trying to cover, three football teams or two and three football teams in, you know, a largely, at least in this market, in a basketball centric area, but you're still trying to do right by those football teams. And it's hard to just like, okay, now I've got to get into the rosters of these teams like in November. Don't do this to me. But yeah, I get it. It is what it is. And TV rules the day in most cases, so I understand that part too.
All cases.
This is fair. I wanted to get into some Twitter questions. We didn't get a ton, but we got a few. This one should be pretty quick. It's from Brant Wilkerson New.
Yes,
so you might be prepared for this one already. Amid the Teal craze of the 90s in sports, get it, David Teal. Teal, yeah.
T-E-A-L, yes.
Yeah, and he even explained it if you needed clarification with the parentheses. Amid the Teal craze in the 90s, sports uniforms and logos, what was your favorite? UNC Wilmington is an appropriate answer, and he is a proud Seahawk. So,
well, I'll tell you what. Since I consider Jerry Wainwright a friend, and he was such a good coach for the Seahawks back in the day, and I also really like Brad Brownell, who coached at UNCW. I'm right there with Brant.
Nice. Okay. He'll appreciate that, I'm sure. Let's get this from Fur Heisman, one of my favorite Virginia Tech folks on Twitter.
That's a great handle, by the way.
Yes, it is.
I mean, most folks outside the outside Blacksburg, Virginia, don't know who Will Fuhrer is, but it's a great reference,
including me. So I do know who it is now because I've looked it up since, but I did not know how it was pronounced. So,
yep.
Fuhrer for Heisman. So there you go. And he's a big fan of punting as well, which I can also appreciate. Let's see. Who is the most interesting or fun athlete or coach that you've covered?
Oh.
Yeah, that's a lengthy list, I'm sure.
That is a lengthy list. Allen Iverson was pretty interesting.
Wow, yes.
Yeah. I mean, I'm going completely non-ACC there. I realize, but you know, the first time I sat down with him, Lauren, was in the bleachers at Bethel High School. He didn't have a tattoo on him. The bowling alley incident had yet to happen. And here's this little guy who my mother, until her dying day, insisted, he is so cute. I mean, she just thought Allen Iverson was the most adorable thing she'd ever seen.
I'm sure he would have loved that.
Oh, I'm sure he would. He would
smile.
Probably
get a kick out of it. Yes.
He absolutely would. And he and I are good now. Trust me, we've had our moments, but we're all good now. But he's about as fascinating and complex a guy, given everything that he went through. Some of it self-induced.
Right.
Others not. He was done wrong by the criminal justice system here, and that led to a lot of bitterness on his part, and also the adults around him, which did not serve anyone well moving forward.
So he was friendly to you, though? He's always been friendly to you, or it's evolved?
No, not always.
Okay,
because there were some tough things to write, and just as there were about Michael Vick.
Right.
After he screwed up his life temporarily and went to the Hooskow out in Leavenworth, and that was not pleasant. But then, coaches, like, I mean, Frank Beamer was as gracious as they can get. And
yes.
Terry Holland was always full of these crazy ideas. I mean, Terry's been talking about freshman ineligibility for he's been flying that flag forever. And
wasn't Dean Smith on that bandwagon as well? Was that one issue?
Oh, absolutely.
They agreed on that.
Yeah, and Dean and Krzyzewski and sitting in Krzyzewski's office is still I don't get to do it often, but when I do, that's
in the fortress. Yeah,
it's always, but it's enlightening. I mean, like, you can talk to the guy about almost anything. No matter what you think of him or Duke, I mean, that's a smart guy. If you're listening to him, you'll learn something.
I was going to say the same thing. It's still somewhat, at least even covering him as long as I have now, it's still, he's an intimidating presence, but he's somebody.
Absolutely.
You still learn something from him from a basketball perspective almost every time you hear him talk, and it's mm-hmm. very cool to cover him. It's not something, it's definitely not something I take for granted, and I'm sure you don't either, it sounds like, so that's great.
No.
We do have one more Twitter question, and I have to get to it because I think it's interesting because it's certainly a perspective that a lot of people have around here about this team that you cover. I am not one of them, as you well know, but this is from Josh W. Goodson on Twitter. Josh is also from Sports Channel 8, which is the show immediately following this one. And he writes, not trolling, and I know Josh isn't trolling, but does he, meaning you, ever get bothered or bored watching so much UVA basketball?
No. I mean, first of all, it doesn't bother me. Now, are some games, I remember a Wisconsin game the ACC Big Ten Challenge.
I can't with those two teams getting together. Now, no.
Now, it was an absolute eyesore.
it's too much.
Yeah, and there was no other way to describe it. But the pace, it's not – Virginia's pace isn't dictated as much by its offense as it is by its defense. They do such a darn good job of guarding you that the shot clock is going to go down because you can't find anything to do.
Right.
And that's – I'm sorry. That's not their fault.
No. I agree.
Figure it out. If you can't figure it out, then that's your problem. And, yeah, the game's going to be in the 50s or the 60s. But, I like numbers. I wasn't a math major, but I love the analytics. And Tony Bennett's best teams have been not only in the top five in offensive efficiency, they've been – or in defensive efficiency, but they've been really good on the offensive side. And I believe last season the Cavaliers led the ACC in three-point accuracy.
Mm-hmm. I think that's right. Mm-hmm.
Now, didn't show against UMBC.
Oh, boy.
But this notion – And I get this all the time, especially after UMBC. And I think a lot of national people took the easy way out, the easy hot take way out.
Yes.
Tony Bennett has to revamp everything or he'll never get to a Final Four.
So silly.
Please. How did Wisconsin get to the Final Four? How did Bayheim and Syracuse get to the Final Four?
I don't want to hear about boring. How did
Right. How did South Carolina and Frank Martin get to the Final Four?
Exactly.
By playing very similar tempos. So spare me this notion that Tony Bennett has to blow it up. It's just patently untrue.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. And I think if I've ever had any frustration with Virginia at times, it's been because when they've had what I felt were like transcendent players like Malcolm Brogdon, like even a Justin Anderson, it was like, let them, there was times where I wanted to scream at Tony, like, let them be the guy that takes over, like, let them take over. We don't have to, you know, it sometimes felt like they were a little too system adherent on offense. And I just wanted, maybe that wasn't my own selfishness,
fair.
But yeah, it was let's let these superstars take over, please. They're very capable of it, but it might've been on them as much as it was on Tony. I mean, I have no idea. I don't have the inside, you know, scoop on that part of it, but
well, but it becomes so ingrained that I think it does affect the players, and I think that's quite fair. And it'll be interesting to watch this team this season, because Kyle Guy was first team All ACC last year. I voted him third team.
I did too. Actually.
I thought he was their third best player. I thought Devin Hall was their best player. I voted him first, and I voted Ty Jerome. I think Ty Jerome is a stone-cold killer.
Yes. No conscience, yeah.
No, completely unafraid. And ask Duke, they know. I mean, that ball fake and the three he made at Cameron, not many people do that in that building.
No.
And he didn't blink. And you put Guy and Jerome now with a Hunter, with a DeAndre Hunter, whom from all accounts knows now that he's a dude, to use Steve Adazio's phrase.
Yes.
And it's got to be frustrating to Virginia coaches to not know whether he's eligible or not. If the Alabama transfer Braxton Key is eligible, then I think this becomes the most athletic team that Bennett has had.
Wow. And that definitely adds a different dimension to them, because that's not – hasn't always been the case, for sure.
Right.
Wow. Okay. Well, that's all the Twitter questions that we have. But before we let you go, I guess we'd be remiss if we didn't ask you, since you cover both teams closely – how you Virginia Tech's getting a lot of hype going into the preseason. I'm an AP top 25 voter. I'm definitely I was joking with a Virginia Tech fan on football recently, because he was saying I didn't know what I was talking about because I'm a basketball writer, essentially, since I'm from the Triangle. And I was like, well, I would have ranked your team in the preseason if it were basketball. So, and I didn't rank the Hokies in the preseason, but it's true. I mean, I do think I'm leaning that way. Is this sort of the year for that program to kind of take that next step under Buzz Williams?
I think it should be. I was just out at their media day yesterday, and trust me, they are, what's the word, frustrated by the last 2 years and failing to get out of the first round. of the NCAA tournament. They're well aware that no Virginia Tech team has advanced since 2007 under Seth Greenberg. They feel like they're stuck in a kind of a 10-8 ACC rut. That's been their record the last three seasons. They think they can do better. I think they should do better. They return almost 78% of their offense, and that doesn't include Ty Outlaw, who's their best shooter, who missed last year with an ACL, and whose emergence late in the 2017 season fueled their run to the NCAAs. With Virginia Tech, it's going to come down just as it has the past couple of years. They got to defend better, and they have to rebound better. If they can do that, they're going to be – I think they're a top five ACC team at the start. And I picked a preseason top 25 for the basketball writers. I had seven ACC teams in that top 25. Duke, Carolina, Virginia, Virginia Tech, Syracuse, Florida State, and Clemson. And I think I had Tech 16th or 17th.
Yeah, that sounds about right. Yeah. It definitely is their time. It's still odd to me, though, watching a Buzz Williams team, considering his history at Marquette and everything else, not rebound and defend as well as he'd like. It's an oddity to me that it hasn't quite translated yet. I'm not sure I quite understand why that is.
Well, you're accustomed to the Jimmy Butlers.
Yes.
and those guys at Marquette who did all that and got after it and got Buzz to two Sweet 16s and an Elite Eight.
Yeah, and he's quite the character as well. I'm sure he'd rank high.
Oh my gosh.
He's a very interesting guy.
He is such a strange ranger, and he would not be offended in the least.
No, I'm sure he would not.
By my saying that. And you talk about another guy who he obsesses over numbers the way Bronco obsesses over organization and scheduling and such. In that way, they're very much alike. Buzz is more random and spontaneous, but in terms of the numbers and the analytics and this, the things he rattles off are pretty amazing. Now, sometimes you got to go back and double check him, but for the most part, he commits them to memory.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy. He's definitely an interesting dude. You have interesting personalities to cover, really, in all four of the major, you know, Virginia Tech football and basketball, and Virginia football and basketball too. So you got plenty to do around there.
Tony Bennett, he's not real accessible from a media standpoint, but I think anyone who watched his response to that UMBC loss, or even the one to Syracuse in the Elite Eight, where Virginia flat out squandered a Final Four bid in the last 6-7 minutes, his gracious way immediately after, and then, you know, there he is at the Final Four in San Antonio last year, kind of sheepishly accepting all these Coach of the Year awards, and he was fabulous. And it would be great to see him maybe have a longer stay in the NCAA tournament and get more and more media attention, because as much as he dislikes it, when he's on that podium and he's speaking from the heart, that guy is compelling.
Yeah. He is David Teal of the Newport News Daily Press. David, thanks so much.
Lauren, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to the Topics and Takes podcast with Lauren Brownlow. You can download this weekly podcast at WRALSportsFan.com and the WRAL Sports Fan app, or subscribe on iTunes and Google Play stores.